Hey everyone, and welcome to the second episode of Forecast. Today we're talking quite a lot about climate oscillations, and if you've heard about any one of them, you've probably heard about El Nino Southern Oscillation. Now, there's tons of other ones like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or the Arctic Oscillation, North Atlantic Oscillation, the Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillation, Southern Annular Mode. There's a lot. But certainly, El Nino is the one that gets the most coverage in the media. And I think the coverage is completely understandable given the fact that it has massive effects. So, for example, in a big El Nino, you'll have a situation in which during December, January, February, or boreal winter, the eastern equatorial Pacific stays anomalously warm. And what this does is to move the center of convection from the western Pacific warm pool more towards the central and eastern Pacific, causing major droughts and oftentimes major fires in Indonesia, and teleconnections or remote effects around many other parts of the planet. But the effects aren't necessarily massive, and they're not always especially predictable. So, for example, my house in Northern California could flood, but it just as well might not flood in the coming 2015-2016 El Nino. My guest today is Matt Collins from the University of Exeter and the UK Met Office. Matt's one of the world's leading authorities on El Nino modeling and also climate modeling in general. And particularly, Matt's worked quite a lot on understanding model uncertainty about future projections. And we talk quite a lot about that, both in terms of El Nino and modeling more generally. We also talk a little bit about how working with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a bit like dealing with a hangover. Atmospheric circulation on Mars, which was Matt's early work, a lot about uncertainties in climate modeling, and then a little bit about how to talk to a statistician. I hope you enjoy. Thanks a lot. Finally, I should note that anything said here is the opinion of the speaker and, of course, doesn't represent the position of Nature, Nature.com, or Nature's publishers. Matt Collins from the University of Exeter and the Met Office. Given our similar ages and your early research, were you also interested in the Martian Chronicles and Edgar Rice Burroughs and John Carter World of Mars?
No, I got into doing Mars stuff after my undergraduate degree. I didn't really kind of know what I could do with a mathematics degree. I picked up this PhD on modelling the Martian atmosphere because I thought it sounded neat, and it was something I could do which I could understand as being a kind of applied mathematics rather than pure mathematics, which I imagined was just looking at equations all day and not very exciting.
So from 1990 to 93, you were working on your pure and applied math degree, is that right?
Well, that was in the meteorology department in the University of Reading. So I was kind of the only person there really doing anything on other planets. Most people were working on terrestrial meteorology and climate.
So working on the Martian modeling, were you looking mostly at atmospheric circulation, or were you delving at all into issues of early Martian oceans and things like this?
No, so we were mainly interested in the circulation, in particular the weather systems, because in the 70s, the Viking mission to Mars measured surface pressure on the planet with relatively high temporal resolution. And what you saw was weather systems on Mars were kind of more regular than they are on the Earth. So particularly in the UK, we experience very irregular weather systems coming across us, you know, only predictable out a few days, maybe maximum a week. On Mars, they seemed much more regular. And that was, you know, kind of the things that we were doing were looking at the kind of fluid dynamical processes surrounding those weather systems.
So does Mars not have vigorous mid-latitude cyclones then?
No, it has very vigorous mid-latitude cyclones. They just seem to come in sort of periodic bursts. So you will see, you know, a series of weather systems. It's essentially, it's like the weather's the same every 3 days. It's probably mainly to do with the fact that Mars is smaller. So the geometry is such that the weather systems are relatively bigger in comparison to the Earth.
So if you weren't into Martian science fiction when you were a boy, what were you interested in?
Mathematics, and latterly computers, I think, was the one thing that really spiked my interest in being a scientist, because suddenly you could solve little equations on computers, and you could do things. I was a part of the generation, you know, the first generation that we could afford home computers that we could have in our bedrooms, and we could program them and play games and things like that. And that was kind of, that opened my eyes to a whole load of new possibilities.
Were you working on the early Apples or building your own machines?
So I actually had a machine called an Oric 1, which was a pretty niche kind of machine. It was kind of similar to a ZX Spectrum, and you could program in BASIC. I even got into doing a bit of machine code. So I was kind of geek as a 14-year-old boy.
You had a fairly cerebral upbringing, then, it sounds like. Were your parents also in science?
No. My father was a planning officer, and my mother, well, did various jobs. So, in fact, I'm the first person in my family to go to university.
What part of England did you grow up in?
So I grew up in the southwest of England, nearby where we are now, but further down towards Cornwall. It's a very beautiful county, but also not particularly rich in terms of employment opportunities and good schools and things like that.
Were your parents completely befuddled by your interest in programming and mathematics and going to university, or were they entirely supportive and understanding?
Oh, they were very supportive. In fact, you know, when I look back, they bought me my first home computer, which I had in my bedroom. And at the time, that would have cost a lot of money for them, actually. So it was great that they thought it was probably an educational tool. I thought it was for playing games on, but it turned out that it was an educational tool because I had to program the games myself.
So you learned BASIC first, then do you move on to Fortran and C afterwards?
So yes, I'm not entirely sure in which order. Early programming would have been done in Fortran or something called Pascal. Today I've been teaching MATLAB to our students, and so all these languages are, in my opinion, kind of similar. You just get confused about the syntax. It's the basic structure, the idea of that you can take some mathematics or take a problem and put it on a computer. That's the valuable lesson that I learned.
When you think about climate models now and the availability of the code behind them, there's a wide diversity of approaches to this. So places like NCARN have full open community models. And from what I understand, the Met Office, the Hadley model, has a variety of flavors, some of which are open access and some of which, particularly the state-of-the-art HadGEM models, are not necessarily open to anyone who wants to take them. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, I mean, it's kind of accurate. I think it's, the Met Office codes are used by other weather services, but the Met Office has kind of controlled the use of those so as that these things do not get out of hand. It's partly because of the amount of resource they have for supporting these codes. They have resource for supporting them internally, but not necessarily supporting them as open source bits of code.
We have quite a few debates in Nature and our other journals about whether or not we should mandate that the code behind modeling papers should necessarily be available. And the overall sentiment, I think, besides me, is that doing so wouldn't even help the cause of transparency because it would take so much effort to understand what's going on and that the potential for misinterpretation is really quite high. And, of course, the usual issue is that you have compiler differences and machine differences. You could never hope to reproduce the results in the first place. What do you feel about that? Do you think there's an inherent value in purely transparency, not in terms of replication, of having codes available?
I kind of agree with you in the sense that, you know, something like the Met Office Unified Model is 500,000 lines of code. It's configurable to do weather forecasting, to do climate work, to do seasonal forecasting. Configuring it in the correct way and setting up the experiment exactly is incredibly difficult. You know, it's part of the skill of being a climate scientist. However, I do think that there's this kind of more intermediate step where we shared some of the code that we did for analysis. So maybe we shared the data that came out of the model and then some of the code that we used for analysis. That would be a great situation. At the moment, we don't have a culture within climate science of doing that. And I think it needs a cultural shift as well as journals demanding it, if you like.
Looking at the Met Office and then Exeter, where you've been, I believe, since 1997... No, in the Met Office, you don't have pressure to obtain necessarily all of your own external funding. And when you're at Exeter, there's I'm sure, a renewed pressure to do so.
Yes.
What do you think that the different funding environments do to you in terms of how you approach science, how you think about science, or the topics you might try to investigate?
Yeah, so the way I used to characterize this, probably still true, is that in the Met Office, We had quite a lot of resource, but very little freedom of what we could do with it. In the university, you have ultimate freedom to do anything you want, but no resource with which to do it. And with resource, I mean, in my case, you know, people to work with to crunch through model output, test hypotheses, you know, by writing code. So, you know, it's all about kind of collaborative work with students and postdocs. Both careers have different sets of challenges. The great thing about being in a university is you really have to think hard about what the next big question is. In the Met Office, you're more looking towards the people who are paying for their service, you know, so they're paying for seasonal forecasting, they're paying for climate information, they're paying for weather forecasting, so you have to serve their needs.
What was that first long-term project for you that you thought, I want to be working on this for the next 5 years?
Well, that's a kind of weird thing, because the things that you think are going to be funded are not funded, and the things that you don't think are going to be funded get funded. So my, you know, the things I'm interested in have kind of diversified a bit. But really it's all been about thinking about future changes in climate, thinking about the uncertainties which are introduced because of errors in the model, and trying to get towards a robust picture of how the climate will change in the future. And there's a particular focus on phenomena such as El Nino and monsoons.
I recently went to a Chapman conference on the global monsoon system. It's held in China, actually Hong Kong. And I went in hoping that I would come out with a better grasp of the overall monsoon system, how it operates, what are the main driving factors, because it's an area of very high submissions to Nature, and the literature is absolutely enormous on monsoons. Yeah. So it's difficult to try and tease out what any one individual paper is contributing to that field. But I actually came out of it even more confused than I went in. And I'm curious, you're working on the South Asian monsoon now with some new collaborators. What do you see as the potential advances that might be coming out over the next few years and try to develop this sort of synthetic understanding of the controls and the future behavior?
The classical picture of the monsoon is of the kind of large-scale sea breeze. So you have the heating, and if it's in South Asia, it's over the Tibetan Plateau, and that induces the winds to flow across the Indian Ocean, and then they dump their moisture in the form of rain in the Indian monsoon. I think really the picture which is emerging is a bit more subtle than that. One way I've seen it nicely characterized is we have these things called intertropical convergence zones, where we have the main rainfall on the planet. They're generally sat over the ocean. What can happen during the summer months, in particular in the Northern Hemisphere, you get a shift of that ITCZ over the land. And I think that's the kind of crucial process to understand, how that ITCZ gets shifted. Does it have to have a source of moisture from the land surface? Is it something to do with the large-scale energetics? We got a recent project started where we're looking at the African monsoon, where it's clear that there's some sort of hemispheric energetic scale constraints on that African monsoon, but also details of regional processes like sea surface temperatures in the region and land surface processes are likely to be important. So it's a sort of combination of the kind of large-scale energetics of the atmosphere and possibly the small-scale processes too.
It's probably safe to say that you're best known for your work on ENSO, El Nino, Southern Oscillation, and you've been working on this topic for a long time. I saw a paper that you wrote, I think back in the 90s, looking at the sort of the theoretical predictability, and you said it was going to be 8 months in principle at the time.
Yes.
Is that still more or less where we are, or have we really gotten past the spring predictability barrier?
I would say it's more or less where we are, but it's obviously incredibly event dependent. We have to think back to 2014, where many of my colleagues and myself were getting very excited that there looked like there was a big El Nino coming, and we were proved entirely wrong.
Was that largely because the westerly wind burst didn't materialize?
It's largely, I think, because the atmosphere didn't get coupled in with the ocean SST anomalies. Now, that is probably because of the spatial pattern of those SST anomalies at the time. So they were too far confined in the East Pacific. It's partly because it was kind of the wrong time of year. So these SST anomalies were happening in the Northern Hemisphere winter, where the ITCZ is too far away from the equator. One way of thinking about ENSO is an El Nino event is it pulls the ITCZ onto the equator. And that is hard to do in Northern Hemisphere winter because that's when it's the furthest point away. This year, something different has happened again, and we seem to be in the process of what looks like a significant event. So I kind of say that every time we have an El Nino event, we have a new theory.
Which makes it difficult, the principle, to believe that we're going to have a coherent theory for El Nino prediction out past a year.
I don't see any strong evidence of a general predictability horizon of a year or more. There may be some events which are predictable because of peculiarities of how they occur.
You're working mostly on modern and future climate and largely in the El Nino system. There's also a fairly rich literature from the paleoclimate in terms of coral records and bivalve records and things like this. To what degree does that inform the work that you're doing on El Nino, or do they tend to operate in combination, or are those communities somewhat separate?
Oh, no, I have a collaboration with a guy called Sandy Tudhope in Edinburgh, and he does this kind of reconstructing past ENSO variability. I think what it's been useful for is setting up hypotheses with which to test our models. Those models haven't necessarily passed those tests. So I still think there are some things, particularly the interaction between the seasonal cycle and ENSO. It appears that there are some periods in time when ENSO variability was very weak. Now, that may be just chance fluctuations, which models can reproduce, but there may be, you know, something a bit more in that. So I think that the paleo data aspect of things is really useful in motivating us to understand how things happened in the past. It doesn't necessarily help you to improve models, but I think you learn a lot about the way the models work and the way that the real system worked in the process.
Looking again to the future, my understanding is that there's still not much model consistency among models in terms of their predictions of El Nino frequency, but that there's more consistency on how they simulate teleconnections from El Ninos in the future.
Yeah, so, the recent work, particularly led by Wenju Chai from the CSIRO in Australia, has shown us that if we think about El Nino events in terms of their rainfall response, then you get this pretty consistent pattern of a shift in rainfall, as a shift in ENSO-related rainfall from the West Pacific more into the Central and perhaps into the East Pacific. I still think, even though I am a collaborator with Chai on these papers, that there is some uncertainty about these results because models still have problems in simulating the mean climate of the Pacific. In particular, they tend to have sea surface temperatures which are too cold. Their warm pool precipitation is kind of more broken up and perhaps too far west. So I still worry about these, even when models agree on a particular finding, that all the models could be wrong because they all have inherent errors and biases.
So you're saying that the mean state biases could themselves be indicative of a larger issue regarding the theoretical model robustness on these teleconnections?
Oh, certainly, yeah. And it's difficult to know how to test for that. Somehow we need to think a bit harder about some of the sets of experiments that we do as a community. We tend to do a basic sort of set of experiments, and you know, maybe we need a more in-depth set of experiments which tries to test out some, you know, if we artificially improve some of these biases, how it would change the results that we see in the future.
So if you were to return to the topics like changes in extreme El Ninos or the South Pacific Convergence Zone, you mentioned that there could be better ways to design experiments to really tease out these issues on mean state biases and these teleconnections that perhaps doesn't exist right now in the CMIP-5 archives. So what kinds of experiments would you like to see?
So the key thing, really, which we don't know, which we'd really like to know, is what the mean pattern of SST change looks like in the future, because we have that from coupled models, but we don't yet have that. You know, those coupled models have biases, so that pattern of SST change might be in error. So you can put that pattern of SST change underneath an atmosphere model and reproduce some of the results of the coupled model. So I think what we need is perhaps some sensitivity tests. And in fact, Jackie Brown, also from CSIRO in Australia, from Hobart has done a nice series of experiments where she modifies that pattern of SST change and see, and you do see a bit of a change in the ENSO precipitation patterns. But we probably need a wider suite of those kind of sensitivity analyses to see what's going on.
One of your new roles, obviously, at Exeter is having graduate students, and I'm wondering, you must have begun this something like in your mid to late 30s, mentoring PhD students. I found that to be quite a difficult task, mostly because it's difficult to imagine how different people are from your own thought processes.
Yes.
And you assume that your grad students, or at least I did, are going to act like you did in similar situations, and they absolutely don't.
Yes.
What was that adjustment process like for you at a relatively sort of mid-career stage?
So luckily I had already had some experience of co-supervising PhD students in the past. But yes, everyone is different, and everyone has different strengths and weaknesses. I'm not entirely sure I've got it right at this stage. It's just a question. What I hope to do is give my students some freedom to develop their own ideas and not to just give them lots and lots of problems and calculations to do, but rather to let them follow their own noses and learn their own lessons in for when things don't go as right as you expected them to go.
I suppose in the UK, where you have typically three-year PhD programs, giving students a lot of free rein has the potential to go completely pear-shaped.
Yes, so we'd start them off with a fairly confined, confined problem. You know, here's some model experiments, analyze them, and maybe produce a paper or tell us what the findings are. So then that hopefully gives them a start, and they can start to develop their own ideas.
What's your sense when your students go out into the world and find good positions and are doing interesting work and publishing in Nature and things like that? Does it give you a lot of tremendous satisfaction or something else?
It's almost the best thing about my job, I would say, to see that, one of my co-supervised students from a number of years ago is now a lecturer at UCL in London. Another one of them...
Is that Chris Brierley?
Chris Brierley, yes. And Sophine Brown, she was actually a postdoc, but now she's working at the Bureau of Meteorology. A guy I supervised at the Met Office, a guy called Ben Booth, had a couple of years ago a lead author paper in Nature.
So, I remember.
Yeah, on the aerosol effect on Atlantic SSTs. So, this is brilliant when this happens.
So in addition to advising PhD students now in your new role, you're also involved in a MOOC on climate change, a massive online course.
Yes.
What's that experience been like for you?
The way we did that course was that we filmed some bite-sized pieces of information, sort of five-minute, quote, lectures. Well, that was quite tough because we had to speak to camera and not fluff our lines. And then we got a lot of the PhD students actually to help out with the online students in sort of generating debates. And we did a few little pieces. That was good fun. We had something like 15,000 students signed up. For our first...
Internationally?
Yes. Now, only 1,500 made it to the end, but that's still 1,500 people who watched all the way through and did some of the exercises and now understand a bit more about the science of climate change, hopefully.
When you're not working on El Niño topics, I know that you also work on the idea of emerging constraints.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, which may not be completely right, it's an approach in which you have... Let's say a process you want to look at in the future and you want to try and figure out the mechanisms that are driving that process and then seek observations of that process or state in the modern climate and then use those to essentially select the model or models that are doing a better job on that process and then use those going forward.
Yeah. So that has proved to be an approach which has worked for a small number of climate variables. And I think the attraction to the community is that it's kind of obvious what is going on. There's no smoke and mirrors in terms of complicated statistical analysis. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to work for every climate variable. And we've been trying some ideas out on tropical water vapor and lapse rate feedbacks with only some limited success, I would say. So we're going to have to think of other neat ways of either selecting models or massaging that output in order to be more confident about their predictions of the future.
Why do processes or states like water vapor not tend to work as well as things like the snow albedo feedback?
In the particular case we were looking at, It looks like there may be a constraint, but actually the problem is the data is not good enough. So it's sort of interesting conclusion for a modeler that in order to improve the projections, we actually have to improve the observations of a quantity. There's just too much noise in them to be able to say whether one model is better than another model.
One question I always have about emergent constraints or just the process of going through and trying to get models that do a better job at the mean SSTs and then using those for ENSO projections is that you're looking at one particular part of the system, whereas there are many other parts of the system that you're not assessing that could be quite horrible for the same subset of models that are doing well on the question of interest.
Yes.
How do you approach that philosophically?
As an example, a concrete example of that, in the IPCC report in the AR5, we selected the models which we felt had good present-day trends in Arctic sea ice extent, September sea ice extent, and use those to make projections of September Arctic sea ice extent. We didn't do that in the case of temperatures, when clearly those two variables would be linked. So there's already an inconsistency, if you like, in that assessment. I think the answer is we have a set of models which are not perfect. We have a collection of different sort of statistical methods. So there's the idea of emergence constraints. There are more complicated Bayesian techniques. There may even just be simple sort of rule out, rule in type statistical analysis we can do. And we have our kind of physical understanding. And what we need is actually a way of putting all these things together and getting them to talk to each other. Often the guys who would say, I understand physical climate change, if you ask them about statistics, they recoil in horror. And vice versa with the guys who do statistics. So I'm trying to, we've got some people here who are interested in both these problems, statistical sides of things and physical understanding kinds of things, and I'm trying to bring them together.
I feel like that division between communities is happening right now in the issue of the teleconnections to mid-latitudes from Arctic sea ice.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
There's been quite a lot of statistical work showing that there are connections. But then when I talk to dynamicists about this, they're pretty uncomfortable. They don't feel that the dynamics are worked out in a believable way.
Yeah.
So with that specific example, what do you think needs to happen among the communities that could help?
They need to start talking to each other. But everyone says that. Yes, my usual trick is to misrepresent or oversimplify their work by explaining it in a paper or something. And then you do get your co-author to actually put you right on. So I once included a very simplified explanation of a Bayesian framework in a paper, and my colleague David Sexton said, no, that's not right, and wrote a very nice description of a Bayesian framework as a consequence.
So you intentionally blunder into a topic.
I'm not sure it's intentional. It may be unintentional.
Bayesian statistics is certainly on the rise. I see it in a lot of papers. Do you feel that there's a major community shift towards Bayesian statistics, or is it going to be frequentist and Bayesian in some kind of appropriate mixture?
Well, I think the Bayesian approach is attractive to me, with my background in mathematics, because it's actually, when you get down to it, quite a simple theory, and seems to me the way that we often look at problems. You know, we have some prior knowledge. We take some data, we take some models, and we update our beliefs about, or we update our knowledge, if you like, about a particular subject. Having been involved in a project in the Met Office to do it in the climate modelling case, all the problems came out in the implementation, because you need large ensembles of models. There are terms in the whole Bayesian framework which you have to specify, which are very difficult, if probably not impossible, to specify. So it's an appealing framework. The implementation is, I fear, too complicated at the moment for where we are with climate modeling.
When you look at the connections that have been shown between the tropics and the high latitudes, looking at Rossby wave connections between tropics governed by El Nino, people like Eric Stegeman working in this, and the West Antarctic ice sheet, do you have an interest in those topics? Does that seem compelling to you, that kind of line of research?
From the work I've seen on the ice core, seems a fairly robust teleconnection between ENSO and the Southern Hemisphere. I'm perhaps more interested, or there seems to be in the community a renewed interest in the North Pacific and the decadal variability there with the connection to the recent hiatus. And is that just the kind of imprint of atmospheric noise, or is there some underlying dynamical mechanisms?
You're talking about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation,
the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or the IPO, whichever you want to call it. Yes.
What's your sense on that question then? Is the now ended hiatus, was it an instance of just random forcings from the PDO, or do you see something else?
It looks very much like natural variability. I don't think that the models have that level of natural variability in them. They have PDO-like behavior, and they can produce hiatuses, but none of the models really produce an event that was that strong. So either there's something missing in the models in terms of the magnitude of that decadal variability, or in fact that the trends that we've seen, and these are kind of multi-decadal trends, are actually outside of what we expect from the climate change signal. So, you know, the trades have strengthened, whereas all the models expect a weakening of the trades in response to climate change. So I think either way, there's a deficiency in the models. Unless, of course, the real world did something which is at the 99.9th percentile of what we'd expect from the models.
It's been interesting to look at the hiatus literature of the past few years, because there was a work by Francis Wires saying that I think that the models are now outside of the range of observations. And then there was a flurry of papers by Calvin Wade, Tom Carl, and Noah Diffenbaugh and a group there saying that even observationally, there actually isn't much of a hiatus, depending on how you treat the data, which brings the question around to, was there actually a problem with the models at all? And then I think again about, I think Paul Valdez had a piece a few years ago looking at models built for stability. And do you think that there actually is a substantial issue about model data mismatch during the hiatus period?
Whether it's serious? Yes, I probably would say that actually, because, you know, despite all the work and the papers that have come after this, this is still something that we weren't kind of expecting. And I still think as a decadal event, it's strong in comparison to all the other. I mean, we have limited information, of course, from the past. But, you know, we should have expected to see decadal wiggles, but I don't think we were expecting to see a decadal wiggle that could have been this size. Whether the hiatus is over or not is still an interesting question.
Oh, you don't buy the hiatus is over arguments?
Never
occurred in the first place?
No, I do. I do. You know, it could possibly be over. This El Nino event will, if the forecasts are right, decay rather rapidly, and the large events do tend to decay rather rapidly. So whether that signifies a termination of a long-term trend, we await with interest what the world would look like in 5 years' time.
When you try and get a grasp on how variable models can be, I think about the work with the CESM large ensembles and showing that depending on very small modifications to the initial conditions, you can get radically different states in terms of precipitation, sort of the ordinal changes in trends and temperature and precipitation. And to me, that seemed like it was actually showing that models really are quite variable if you approach them in the way that they probably ought to be looked at, which is in these very large ensembles. Do you think that the perception that models aren't all that variable is an artifact of computational limitations and people not running large ensembles?
So I think perhaps, you know, referring back to the Paul Valdez piece, you know, we shouldn't confuse variability with stability. Yes, I mean, models have always been variable. I think the work that you're referring to with the large CSM ensemble, models are particularly variable over the US. That's a kind of bit of a mystery, actually. I'm not sure if you plotted those figures over Europe, you'd see a similar kind of wide range of different precipitation.
And there's no theory for that?
It's probably something to do with the Pacific. But I think stability, you know, is a dynamically a different. So if we imagine that variability is just the noise and there's a background manifold which indicates the stability of the system, sure, if you have larger variability and you have an unstable system, you're more likely to see that instability. I know Paul very well. You know, I've seen the sort of work that he's basing on. It's still quite a leap to conclude that all models must be built for stability, because, you know, this isn't something that you build into a model. You build in what your best estimate of the physical processes are. You don't specify somehow the underlying manifold or the underlying stability.
You've also worked quite a bit on the idea of climate sensitivity. And we've had a lot of recent submissions to Nature that are looking at reconstructions of CO2 prior to the ice core record. So you have methods like the Alkenon method and the Boron method. And they're in some ways all trying to get at the idea of, has there been a major change in climate sensitivity in the past, and how can that then infer our conclusions about future change? But the reality is that the proxies are still quite uncertain. And from your perspective, in that particular question about the proxies and CO2 and a deeper understanding of climate sensitivity, how do you and your colleagues approach the proxy data, the pre-ice core data?
The idea that climate sensitivity could be different in a different epoch and a different, you know, geological time in the Earth's history is absolutely fine. And it was never defined not to be. Climate sensitivity was something the modelers thought up because you could take an atmosphere model and you could couple in a slab, a simple mixed layer ocean, and you could double CO2. And that was a shorthand way of working out what the sensitivity of the system would be. And it turned out that that climate sensitivity was useful in predicting the behavior of fully coupled climate models and under different scenarios and things like that. But it was never kind of designed, I think, to be this universal constant that must be, that can be found and would apply to all past climates or even in all future climates when the CO2 is significantly higher.
Looking at your work with the IPCC, you hear a lot of complaints, or not complaints, more like concerns, that there's this huge community of scientists who are essentially donating volunteer labor for the process. But then I also think about your own papers and the fairly vast network of collaborators you have. Is there a positive sense for you in working with the IPCC because of the kind of collaborations you develop that end up being professionally fulfilling?
Well, if I said that PhD students was the greatest thing about my career, IPCC, you know, working with a group of scientists who are engaged and are interested in a particular problem and are generally at the top of their game, that's a really good. And that was the fun bit of the whole IPCC process. And of course, the whole process does force you into actually making assessments about climate variables, not just saying we need more research, but actually saying what is our best estimate of the climate sensitivity or the rate of Arctic September sea ice decline, etc., etc. So having those debates with people was quite tough, but I think good discipline for any climate scientist, because it's not just a case of saying, well, I just need a better model. You have to write down a number.
Within the scope of your involvement with the IPCC, were there certain topics that proved to be much more difficult to discuss and reach a consensus?
Oh, I mean, the whole frustration for me was how little we said about regional climate change, or what I like to call sort of large-scale regional or spatial patterns of climate change. You know, so we had, you know, even as far as not being able to nail down what the land-ocean warming ratio is. So that's the how much more the land warms more than the ocean. So we've got estimates of climate sensitivity, assessment statements about that. But that's kind of almost pointless when you don't know what the land-ocean warming ratio is, because a 2-degree warming could be up to a 3-degree land warming, or it could be as little as a 2.2-degree land warming.
And is that uncertainty just driven by the lack of data on the topic? It seems like it should be
It's more driven, I think, by the lack of studies. You know, because with IPCC, you're doing an assessment of the literature, and you need to have a number of studies to build an assessment statement. So if you look at the case of climate sensitivity, you know, there's 10, 20 papers that we drew upon to make those assessment statements. Those other variables, there's only a few, so you can't base a concrete assessment statement, if you like, on only a handful of studies.
Talking to people like Tom Delworth, it seems like there's a potential, at least, that for certain variables and for certain parts of the world, that regional climate change might be more predictable than it is in other locations, based on the sort of so-called modes of variability, the movement of the westerlies, for example, and how that might impact the southern coast of Australia. Is that an interesting way to pursue regional climate change, sort of not trying to get the answer everywhere, but to focus on certain areas where you have the better chance of getting an answer?
Yes, yeah, I think that's the way forward. And to me, the topics are this land warming ratio, the polar amplification as kind of large scale factors, and then I think a focus on tropical precipitation, storms and blocking, and probably sea ice Arctic processes are the kind of things that we've done quite a bit of work on them already, but we can go the extra mile to close off a few options and to apply a few different approaches to these projects, to these problems, such that we could get to a point in AR6 where we'd be able to make an assessment statement, say, about storms and blocking of Europe or something like that.
Will you be involved in AR6?
No idea. The process, I guess, is probably about to start up again. I suppose the question is, do I want to be involved?
Do you want to be involved in AR6?
As I said, it was an incredibly rewarding process from the point of view of working with the other scientists. It is an incredibly time-intensive process.
Did you track your hours during that process?
I didn't. I don't have the... Yeah, I'm not disciplined in that way.
I guess it would have been too horrible to contemplate, probably.
Yeah, maybe. Jonathan Gregory, he has a record. I always say to people, you know, when you get drunk and you have a really bad hangover, you think, I'm never going to drink again. And then, you know, a few days later, well, maybe I'll just have that beer.
Just that night. So looking ahead maybe towards, if you were involved in AR6 and writing that assessment report, what kinds of questions do you think are going to be answerable then that weren't answerable previously, besides the issues of regional climate change?
Well, okay. That's, you know, the regional climate change, I guess, is my interest. One thing in particular stands out in my mind, which was the closing of the budgets for the historical sea level change. That seemed to me, in terms of an endeavour of scientists from many different disciplines, glaciologists, oceanographers, to be able to do that was an impressive task. Of course, it's closed within the error bars on the various terms, which are still quite large. So I think squeezing down some of those error bars is, I guess, the challenge.
And finally, getting back to your day-to-day life now, do you still get into the models and write code, or are you more in an advisory capacity, having other people carry through your ideas?
Yes, sadly, I'm now more in an advisory position, but I still enjoy doing some coding when I have the opportunity.
Which must be not very often at this point, I'm guessing.
I'm afraid not.
But you could, right?
Well, the problem is in... getting into a big piece of code, that's what I kind of really want to do. But just starting that always looks like it would take a long time. But I would encourage people to keep on with your coding, because that's where I came from, as we're going right back to the beginning now, you know. And that's still the thing that I can get interested in. I had to do some coding this week, actually, for my MATLAB class. To code up the solutions of the problems that I'd set them. So that was good fun. I enjoyed that.
Matt Collins, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.